Reed Hunt is the former chairman of the FCC under Bill Clinton, during which time Howard Stern said he should die of cancer, and was also a member of President Obama's transition team. He's the recent author of A Crisis Wasted, based on his up-close disappointment with the Obama presidency. This is Reed Hunt. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tech. All right, I'm here with Reed Hunt. Sir, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So you were part of the transition team for Obama, and I believe Clinton as well, but you've written a book here called A Crisis Wasted. The crisis you're referring to is the Great Recession, and you were part of Obama's transition team. First off, could you explain a little bit what your role on that transition team was?
I led the team that reviewed all of the agencies involved in the economy, the Department of Treasury, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Fannie Mae, et cetera, and we sent teams to meet with the incumbents in the Bush administration and basically find out what was going on so that we could make some immediate decisions or make recommendations to President-elect Obama about the immediate decisions.
Okay, and there were expectations from people on the left, and I mean people on the right too, that Obama was going to govern like an FDR-style liberal. And a lot of the thesis of your book is that this crisis that was handed to us was wasted because he did not do that. When did it become clear to you that he was not going to govern in that style?
During the transition, I went to Peter Orszag and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and said, a way to take full advantage of the opportunity of this crisis would be to create a green bank, a public-private source of investment that would move the economy from the carbon platform to the clean power platform. And Summers said, we don't want to do that because we don't want the government to be loaning money. And Orszag said he didn't want to spend any government money that wasn't necessary. And Geithner said it wasn't really his job. And that's when I realized that there was no one in the critical decision-making roles reporting to President-elect Obama, there was no one who was going to advocate some big transformation in the economic structure of the country as part of the response to the crisis. If there was going to be anything big done, it would be a really big effort to restore the Wall Street banks to their primary position in running the economy. And secondly, anything else was going to require regulatory legislation that would take quite a while and ultimately, in the case of climate change, it never passed. So that's when I realized that the response to the economic crisis was not going to include measures that would be directed at changing the systems in America in a significant way. And that was pretty depressing.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice. When you mentioned in the book, and this is kind of a cliche, as you've said in Washington, that personnel is policy. And you mentioned the fact that when you came to them with this idea of the Green Bank, which is, I think, a great idea, we should talk more about it, but you came to them and they didn't want to spend money, they didn't want to add to the debt. And this notion of frugality was tied to, as you describe them, a lot of Clinton world people who came in and filled personnel roles, and a lot of neoliberal style people coming in and filling those roles. Why did Obama pick these people if they did not represent the agenda of his campaign, or did they?
Well, they did represent the agenda of his campaign. He didn't begin his campaign with the anticipation that he would be trying to pull the country out of the Great Recession or deal with the financial crisis, because when he began his campaign at the very beginning of 2007, the recession hadn't begun, and even the financial crisis, hadn't yet even sent out the early warning signals. Let's just get the dates, you know, settled. He began his campaign officially in the beginning of 2007, and actually decided to run approximately December 2006. Okay, it was 1 year later, in August of 2007. That there was a run on the European bank called BNP Paribas, that it was the first clear signal that there was shakiness in the global financial system. And then the next marker was March of 2008, when Bear Stearns, the big American investment bank, was about to go bankrupt. And so the Fed had to step in and loan money to JPMorgan Chase at very, very generous terms, so that Jamie Dimon could buy Bear Stearns. And then that was a clear signal understood by everybody in the Bush administration and by the Obama people as well, that the financial system was on very, very shaky grounds, and probably there would be another failure and a run on one or more banks. And it was very clearly understood by Secretary of Treasury Paulson by March of 2008 that Lehman Brothers would probably go bankrupt. Didn't know it for sure, but probably would go bankrupt. And he was told in March of 2008 by Larry Summers at a conference at Stanford that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were already insolvent and that they were definitely going to go bankrupt. Obama, meanwhile, was running a campaign based on wanting to pass four major pieces of legislation that would be what he called structural reform, and they were fundamentally regulatory. One was for education, one for finance, one for climate change, also you could call it the energy sector, and then the last was for healthcare. So he had these four pieces or pillars of legislation that he wanted to pass. He didn't have a plan in March of 2008 for dealing with the financial crisis, and he didn't have a plan for dealing with the Great Recession. On the other hand, all of Obama's economic advisors and the Bush advisors were part of what I will call the neoliberal, neoconservative consensus, the Washington consensus for domestic policy that had prevailed since Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976. More or less, Democrats and Republicans from 1976 through to 2008, and so that's 32 years, had agreed on market fundamentalism. They had agreed that the financial sector in the country should decide how much money there was in circulation and should create and allocate capital, and that trusting in the market was the way to achieve efficiency and productivity gains, and therefore rising standard of living for all Americans. And that was the Washington consensus from 1976 to 2008. The problem is that in 2008, it was clear from the moment of the Bear Stearns failure that was saved by the J.P. Morgan purchase of Bear Stearns. It was clear from that moment that the financial market was capable of monumental stupidity, of staggering stupidity beyond the imagination of any of the players in the market or any economists. And the stupidity was composed of two things. Number one, a incredible exaggeration of the values in housing and expectations of increasing values. And number two, the creation of extremely esoteric financial instruments that fundamentally would have little to no value if housing did not continue to go up in price. So these two colossal mistakes in the financial market jeopardized the ability of all the big players in the financial sector to continue to attract deposits and to be able to borrow money and put them at risk of runs, which in turn would trigger a cascade of runs on other banks, which in turn would mean that credit would be frozen and new loans would not be made. And then the businesses of the real economy, where real people have real jobs, would be crippled because they wouldn't be able to borrow money, and they wouldn't be able to sell products to companies that were borrowing money to buy those products. And in short, you'd have deflation, and you'd have firing, and you'd have investment dropping, and you'd have the Great Recession. So it was crystal clear to everybody in the financial industry and all the economists that the neoliberal, neoconservative consensus about the fundamental wisdom of the financial markets was wrong. It wasn't that it would always be wrong. It was wrong that it was just that it was in 2008 hugely, grossly, staggeringly wrong. And what was to be done about that? And the reaction of Treasury Secretary Paulson, Fed Chairman Bernanke, Tim Geithner, their colleague who was running the New York Fed, and most of the economists that knew about all this, the reaction was, oh, my God, nothing like this is ever supposed to happen. And number two, now what are we going to do? Big question mark. And so for Barack Obama, there weren't really any advisors around to come in and give him a package of solutions that could be really, really helpful in protecting the real people with real jobs in the real economy, you know, from the devastating effects of the mistakes that the financial markets, you know, had produced.
Right. That's when you say that there was no one around him to give him alternatives to the, say, like the Geithner point of view. One of the things I wanted to ask you about has to do a little bit with campaign finance. There's a famous email that was released by WikiLeaks. I don't know if you've seen it, but it shows the CEO of Citigroup essentially handing the Obama team a list of people that he would like in the cabinet. And if you look at the results, it's really close to who wound up being hired. How, and I should add that Wall Street in the 2008 election donated more money to Obama than it did McCain. How much of this wasted crisis is at least in part because of donors who bought access to the Obama campaign?
Well, you're making a really, really good point. The neoliberal, neoconservative consensus was both a ideological agreement, meaning economists associated with the Democratic Party and those associated with the Republican Party pretty much agreed on trusting markets for the creation and allocation of capital. And it also was a political consensus that based on the following, which is whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you need rich people to give you money to fund your campaign. That is because the gradual loosening of all restrictions on funding campaigns, which hadn't been completely loosened by 2008, but were gradually being loosened all through the time period from 1976 to 2008, led to both parties' presidential candidates and their candidates for most other offices believing that the way to get money to run a campaign was to, frankly, be popular among affluent people. And the very affluent are the those who work in the financial industry. What are the other sources of really big money? Well, they are people in Hollywood and the entertainment industry. But overwhelmingly, they're people that have made their money in finance. And so in both parties, all through the 90s and on into the zeros, and the candidates felt, I just can't get elected on a national level if I don't become acquainted with and fundamentally popular among investment bankers. And so Barack Obama saw that that was a necessity, and he did get to know those people, and they did support him. What did that mean generally for Democrats? It meant that the way to be successful was to be socially liberal and fiscally conservative. That you had to be a market fundamentalist, but you could also stand for socially liberal positions, and the primary one would be freedom of choice, or also called abortion rights. What's the difference between that and Democrats? Well, they were also, and Republicans, they would also be fiscally conservative, but they wouldn't be socially liberal. They would be socially much more linked to evangelical Christians and be against abortion, and generally speaking, be very, very slow to be in favor of gay marriage, and generally speaking, be a little dubious about immigration. The main difference would be a point of view about social issues. On the business side, both parties in the 90s and in the zeros were fiscally conservative, and the only real difference is that the Democrats would tend to want to have a regulatory solution to climate change and the Republicans not. And the Democrats would want a regulatory solution to health care, and the Republicans would not. And but these were differences of degree. What was missing in the 90s and the zeros was some political party that was the voice of members of the real economy. That was what was missing. There was no political party that really represented the point of view of progressives, what we now call progressives. There was no political party in either the Democrats or the Republicans that would say, I know the middle class is not doing well. I know that the standard of living of all Americans is not really going up. In the 90s, in the last 5 years of the 90s, very much because of the technology revolution that I was happy to be part of as the FCC chair, for the last 5 years of the 90s, all the income levels in the United States did better. But that was not the case in the 1970s or 1980s or the first part of the 90s, and it was not the case in the zeros. But there was no political party that said, I speak for the middle class. There was no presidential candidate who said, I am your voice, until the worst possible person from Obama's perspective, became the nominee of the Republican Party. It was Donald Trump who said that. But there wasn't anyone saying that in 2008. So it's those unheard people. It's those silent Americans who were the ones who weren't listened to by any of the decision makers in dealing with the financial crisis. Their views weren't even sought. All the decision makers, Bernanke, Paulson, Geithner, they were all extremely well acquainted with the people in the financial sector. And of course, you know, Geithner had worked with them for years at the New York Fed. And Hank Paulson was one of them as the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. He had all the phone numbers of all the investment bankers, you know, managers, the top CEOs. He had all them, available to him. Probably he had their emails on a BlackBerry. He probably didn't have an iPhone. It had only been introduced in 2007. But that was his world. So those are the people he was listening to. And what did they want? They wanted the mistakes of the financial sector fixed by government. They didn't want their preeminence challenged, and they didn't want any new burdens or duties or obligations to be put on the financial sector. They just wanted everything to be put back the way it had been before the risk of these bank runs. And so that was what he set about doing. He set about thinking about how to restore the financial system to the position of confidence that it had enjoyed, you know, from the mid-1970s through to 2008. He didn't have a agenda of improving the standard of living for all Americans, and so there wasn't any plan to do that that was generated by Paulson or Bernanke or Geithner.
Right. And to your point there, there's been a lot of talk since then when people discuss the shortcomings of the Obama administration. A lot of people mentioned the Republicans in Congress obstructing Obama's agenda. But at one point, he did have a supermajority in the Senate. And from what you've described, it seems like there was actually, in some cases, obstruction occurring inside the administration. For instance, the stimulus. The proposals that Obama was given, I think you mentioned like the highest one was $800 billion, whereas they'd calculated amongst themselves that it would take something like over $1 trillion to bring the economy back up to full employment. I'm not involved in politics at all, so I'm just curious, how is that possible for people who work for the president to do that, to hide information from him without getting fired?
Yeah, where are you asking a good question? Let me break it into two pieces. First, there's a story being repeated in rich detail by Paulson, Geithner, and Bernanke that more or less boils down to the following statement. You really can't trust Congress. They don't ever do the right thing unless there's a terrible crisis, and even then they don't necessarily do the right thing. And you really can't count on them because Congress is just not capable of doing the right thing. This just isn't a true statement. Let's just briefly rattle off the things that Congress did that members of the executive branch in both the Bush and Obama administration asked Congress to do. And I'm talking about Congress, you know, Republicans and Democrats. Number one, in early 2008, there was a stimulus package. It was all tax cuts that the Democrats and Republicans agreed to very quickly. And it was not quite, but close to $200 billion. And so Congress did that. In the summer of 2008, Paulson and Bernanke said that they'd finally come to agree with what had been told to Paulson by Summers in March, namely that Fannie and Freddie were insolvent. And they asked Congress to give the Treasury the authority to take over those companies and to guarantee all of their loans with the full faith and credit of the United States. And Congress passed that. There was a bill called HERA, H-E-R-A, and Congress gave the Treasury unlimited money, infinite money, to guarantee all the debts the payment of all the debts of Fannie and Freddie, and thereby to guarantee that their securities, which were sold on a global level, would be good as gold, good as the American currency. Congress did that right away. After the Lehman bankruptcy, Paulson and Bernanke went to Congress and said, we want $700 billion to buy troubled assets, which means bad loans, from banks. And Congress said, you know, that seems like a crazy idea. And then they wouldn't vote for that. But then Paulson said, okay, well, how about if I invest in these companies instead of buying their bad loans? And Congress said, that's fine. And that was passed. And overall, that took 3 weeks. It took Paulson twice as long to figure out what to do with the money. And then in between the first week in January and the first week in February, Congress passed the $700 billion stimulus. That was just 1 month. And there are more examples, but those are all examples of Congress. When it's given the information and when it's told that it's an emergency, they act right away. The people who didn't act right away were Paulson and his people, who after the Bear Stearns bankruptcy essentially did nothing at all to mitigate the dreadful effects that they knew would result from the Lehman bankruptcy that they expected, did nothing at all to ask Congress to help them stop Lehman from going bankrupt, and then had no coherent plan for figuring out what to do after Lehman went bankrupt. So the history here is that Congress actually did act quickly, repeatedly. It was Paulson and his colleagues who are the ones who didn't act quickly. So that's a, let's just say that what I'm saying to you is not the history that Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner are writing.
Right. Yeah, they're, I don't know if you've read their memoirs that have come out, but the basic response that I think to your book that you would get from a lot of people in the administration was that, or at least the story that I've heard them tell is that, you know, well, we had a lot going on at the time, two wars, recession, this financial crisis, and, you know, maybe we made some mistakes, but at the end of the day, we rescued the economy. For you, why is that response not good enough?
It depends on what you think your job is, right? If you think your job is to let the big banks on Wall Street get bigger by buying up smaller ones, and if you and then get economically strong, and also be able to have all their managers keep their jobs and pay all their bonuses, and in short, restore the biggest banks to their role as the primary actors in the economy. If that's your job, they succeeded in that. They succeeded very quickly. By May or June of 2009, that job was done successfully, if that's what you think your job is. If you think your job is a rapid restoration of economic stability for the overwhelming percentage of Americans and the creation of a path to a high and rising standard of living for all Americans, if you think that's your job, then they have to admit that they failed. Why? Because it's not what happened. Because it took 10 years for inflation-adjusted real estate values to return to what they had been. We're still looking for evidence that the middle class is seeing a high and rising standard of living. We still don't have truly affordable health care for most people in America. And we absolutely don't have any government action to of any real adequate scale and scope to move from the carbon platform to the clean power platform and thus save us all from the catastrophe of climate change. And, you know, we only have to look at the news out of Australia to see just how horrible it's actually going to be.
Can I ask you, sorry to interrupt, but can I ask you something about that really quick, though? This is an argument that I think a lot of people, but particularly I feel people in my generation look at the government and look at what's going to happen with climate change, and they see the inaction, and it makes people lose faith in the legitimacy of the project of our government. In other words, if we have something, like as you said, that will bring about, I mean, terrible catastrophe that is coming on the horizon and no one's doing anything about it, how can Americans be expected to have any faith in their government at all?
Total agreement. I mean, you know, as you asked me at the beginning, you know, when I went to those three people and said, let's create a green bank and capitalize it with billions of dollars and then let it loan hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, from 2009 to 2019 to build the clean power platform. And they said, we don't have time for that. We need to focus on, you know, putting the Humpty Dumpty of the Wall Street banks, you know, back together. Well, that was pretty discouraging for me. And, you know, you didn't know about it at the time, but you know about it now. And looking back on it, you're saying to me, it's pretty discouraging for you. And I would say, yeah, because here's the thing. It all depends on what your job is, right? So if you're Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner, and you think your job is to restore the financial sector to a position where it's essentially running the economy, they did a good job at that. If you think their job instead is to help government solve problems of collective action, to do what needs doing, but can be done so well by nobody except government, that's Abraham Lincoln's definition of the purpose of government. If you think that, well, then they clearly failed. And the problem here is that there wasn't anyone in 2007, 8, and 9 speaking on behalf of the people effectively to the decision makers. And so that is why in 2016, you're able to see Donald Trump say, you know, I'm taking over the Republican Party. I'm having it be the voice of the people. And then meanwhile, you also see from 2016 to the present, that the failure to do the right thing for the members of the real economy has now split the Democratic Party and its coalition between of Wall Street and low-income people and highly educated people. That's totally fractured. And so now the party is split between progressives, those are Sanders and Warren's voters, and the rest. And nobody knows how the party is going to come together or who it's going to nominate. These are the outcomes of the choices made in 2007 through 2009. The Republican Party has been seized by Donald Trump, and the Democratic Party is fractured.
On that same note, talking about 2016, one of the things in your book, one of the comparisons you make that I felt was really troubling was China's response to the recession, where basically you describe how if you know you control for the different population and size of the economy, China basically approved the stimulus that Obama's economic advisors had estimated would be the best option for the U.S. Do you worry that if an authoritarian country like China handles their response to a crisis better than we do, that makes America more vulnerable to falling into the arms of a strong man or abandoning democracy?
Thank you for that close reading and that very astute observation, and I think that we're seeing it right now. Meaning, if government doesn't listen to and explain and show people that it's really listening to people, well, then a single human being, you know, who's able to persuade the forgotten people that he or she speaks for them, that single person is going to gain passionate support. And that's what you see right now with the phenomenon, you know, that Donald Trump, you know, has a unwavering commitment from 45, 46, 44% of the population. He's earned that unwavering commitment by convincing those people that he does speak for them and does listen to them. Now, you know, does he deliver for them? Well, you can say, you can make a pretty good argument that he doesn't. On the other hand, you have to concede that he tells them symbolically and substantively and via Twitter and in every way you can imagine that he is listening. And as compared to a political party that, you know, has shown that it doesn't listen, well, the person that makes the claim, you know, is going to get the support. So, you know, one of the secrets of Barack Obama's personal success is that he convinced people that he cared about them. But his advisors, not so much.
Right. And that's one of the things that has frustrated me and puzzled me about the Democratic Party is, and I don't know if this is an ideological thing or just an aesthetic, but the Democrats seem to be very timid about using power. Especially, they had a supermajority, but they chose to bargain with Republicans. Why did the Obama administration spend so many months in the beginning trying to compromise with Republicans on all their major legislation?
You know, I think the truth of the matter is that we don't fully know because we don't have the memoir of Barack Obama. We don't have memoirs of Peter Orszag or Rahm Emanuel. This topic is glossed over by the memoir of David Axelrod. We don't have access to all the emails. But generally speaking, from the 1970s through to 2009, the Democratic Party's coalition was based simultaneously on a commitment to improve the well-being of low-income people and to get financial support from people on Wall Street and otherwise in the financial industry. With that kind of coalition, it's pretty difficult to be politically bold. Your financial donors don't want you to be. And so you get accustomed to playing by what I will call conventional processes. Of course, the thing is that, you know, the Republicans, meanwhile, you know, are showing a greater willingness to actually pay attention to the wishes of the voters, their voters anyhow. And so their voters say, we don't know why you need 60 votes to confirm judges. We don't know why you ought to be cooperating with the Democrats to pass things that we don't like. You know, we like you, Republicans, when you are in opposition. And so Mitch McConnell and the others say, we're not going along with all these things. And so you have the Republican Party listening to their voters and being in opposition. And you have the Democratic Party paying more attention to their donors. You know, not that anyone's thought this in any given day, but really in reality, you know, paying more attention to the people that didn't want the boats rocked than to actually recognize that the situation was one in which democracy should govern. And what does it mean democracy should govern? It means if you have the majority of the country behind you, the national popular vote should elect the president, and you ought to trust that majority and have it be that if it gave you 51 votes in the Senate, that's enough to pass what needs passing. But that wasn't the way the Democrats had played the game for the previous 30 years. And then when it came to a crisis, they didn't have the right attitudes.
What about things like Fox News and talk radio? Do you think that they were overly reactive to some of the right-wing media?
Absolutely, yes. I think it's important to remember, number one, that in 2008, social media wasn't what it is now. The iPhone had been introduced only in 2007, and Democrats trusted the mainstream media to help get their message out. And when the so-called marginal media, like talk radio, with very tiny market shares and very tiny audiences, nevertheless produced a tremendous amount of loyalty and fervor among Republicans, it distressed Democrats, but they also didn't know what to do about it. You know, what's happened since then, I think, is extremely interesting, and here's what it is in a nutshell. It's no longer necessary to run a presidential campaign with a lot of attention being paid to Wall Street money. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and even Donald Trump, and certainly Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, they all show that you don't need to spend your time meeting with and listening to and talking to financial sector people in order to run a presidential campaign. You can do it with your own money if you're Bloomberg or Steyer. You can do it with your own money up to a degree if you're Trump, or you can use social media like Sanders and Warren to raise a tremendous amount of money online. This is a good thing for democracy, very, very interesting, but it also means that the coalition that has supported the Democrats from the 70s to the president really now is kind of at a loss to figure out where it's supposed to get its money, because progressives will contribute. And so the source of money seems to actually pull the party to the left. And then the rest of the people are, the Amy Klobuchars and the Bidens, whatever, they're saying like, well, but that isn't really where we want to be to get the votes. Well, you're going to have it be that you're then getting money from the same people that you're saying are going to vote for you. And that remains to be seen.
The last question I wanted to ask you, the crisis, wasted as it was, is now over. So besides creating a valuable piece of history, why did you bother writing this book?
That's a really good question. First of all, I don't think that the economic problems of America are at all over. It's beyond merely an economic problem to figure out what to do about climate change. And it seems really clear to me that, and I'm not alone in saying this, it's really clear that we are not acting collectively in the United States in a way that is going to meet the requirements of the move from carbon to clean. So that's not over. Number two, delivering affordable health care to all Americans, including the middle class, that's not over. We don't do that. Having it be that you can go to college and beyond college and not have it cost too much money, that's not over. So these big problems of collective action aren't over. They haven't been solved. And so they have to get solved. That's thing one to say. Thing two to say is that crises will come again. There's nothing wrong with a fractional banking system. There's nothing wrong with using capitalism to create wealth. But it's also true that depending on the private sector in an uncoordinated, largely unregulated way to always deliver the best outcomes, clearly is not going to work every single year, all the time. And so we are going to have other economic downturns and other financial crises, and we're going to need to be dealing with them. But I think that the lesson of history here is to have very different techniques, not the same techniques that were used in 2007 and 2009. So that's the reason to write the book.
On that note, Reed, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and thanks for such a good, careful reading of the book. And can you send me a link to whatever you decide to put out there on our friendly internet?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Thank you to Reed Hunt, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.